The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
At 9:23, what a pleasure to welcome Marita Conlon McKenna into the programme this morning. Welcome, Marita. Nice to see you again.
Thanks, Ryan. Thanks for having me on.
You know, every time I mention your name to people, there's of a certain vintage. They always say, oh, Under the Hawthorn Tree is the most important book I read because it was so informative and so formative for so many school kids in recent times. You must get a lot of love about that.
It's a very special book. It was written with love for my daughter and never intended it to be published at all, only for my family. Then my publisher took it and it has become such a special book to children, not just in Ireland, but across the world. It's used in New York, it's used in Mexico, it's used all over the world. Children are reading it in different languages. And it's just become a huge book that keeps going and keeps trucking and people keep reading. One generation reads it, another generation reads it, and lots of adults read it.
Yes.
And just love this. It's a very, very simple story told very simply because it was written for my daughter. And it's just amazed me what it has done.
It's a gateway type. It's the type of book that's a gateway for children and indeed some adults to history, to learn. And that's what, I mean, you came across, just briefly before we talk about the next phase, but you came across this story about just children buried under a tree and bones. I mean, it's such a grim genesis of a story, but it's not a story that you should be shied away from.
No, it was a little school down the country and they were putting on a football pitch and they were clearing this field to make a football pitch and there was a big hawthorn tree in the middle of it. And obviously they cut down the hawthorn tree and then they went to take the roots out, a bulldozer came. And when the poor man started to take up the roots, he saw a skull and he saw a bit of a skeleton. And then, unfortunately, there were three skeletons. The man got a terrible fright and the work had to stop. And I was just listening at home and I heard the story and I said, oh my God, that's incredible. And the children used to play in this field and it was the children playing in the field and the children buried not even very deeply underground that had been hidden there for so many years, that just I, small children myself, made this connection with me. And then that night I remember I went to bed and I didn't see skeletons. I saw three children on their feet. Now, admittedly, they were very emaciated and very thin and skeletal looking, but they were alive. And I just felt like a ghost finger saying to me, we want you to write the story.
When you say you saw them, what do you mean?
I actually could picture them in my head. I could see them. And I knew they were going to walk. I knew a journey and walking was part of this. And I grew up reading all the classic children's books. And a lot of the classic children's books had a journey kind of element to them. Mm. And I just felt these children were going to make a journey and they're going to see things that children should not be seeing, really, but they were part of it. And I just took out my pen and I remember the next day at the kitchen table wrote the first chapter. And actually one of my friends lived up the road and I ran up through it at her and said, read and see what you think, because she knew I was writing at the time. I was writing stuff in newspapers and magazines and I'd done a picture book. And if she had said to me, you're mad, don't do it, but she just phoned me and said, please write the next chapter.
You're in. Yeah, you're in.
And I wrote it then. Never intended it to be published. And then when I wrote it then, one or two people read it and my husband, they kept saying, please send it to a publisher. And then I just sent it to O'Brien Press, who a great Irish publisher.
Of course.
And they took it on and published it.
And so it began. You know, I was talking about this film I went to see called Jojo Rabbit. Now, I'm not sure if you've seen that.
But I haven't.
Okay, so it involves Nazi Germany and it's through the eyes of a child. And
yeah.
There's a lot of children coming into the cinema because it's 12A. So see if your kids are under 12, they should be coming. But there were, I'd be inclined to be quite open about it. I'll bring them in, they'll be fine, they have to learn somehow. But there were a couple of moments in it which involved the punishment at the time would be public hangings.
Yeah.
And you saw the body. I thought, oh, I don't know if under 12s would be up for or to that. So I'd be as in two minds about that. But that's one thing. When you're dealing with dead children dying of hunger and bones and so forth, how sensitive do you have to be? And, you know, this is because you're teaching history and yet you can't shy away from, as I say, the...
Well, in Under the Hawthorn Tree, I remember I just knew, I mean, instinctively when I started writing the book, three skeletons had been found under a hawthorn tree and I knew a child had to be buried under a hawthorn tree. So the very start of Under the Hawthorn Tree, the three children, Eileen, Michael and Peggy, their little sister Bridget dies, she's a baby, and the mother buries her under a hawthorn tree. And I remember, I was thinking, you're mad to put that in a children's book. No one will let anyone read it.
Yeah.
But they did, because I said, it would be, how could you ever write about the family and not have people dead. Like it would be foolish out and really unfair and trying to hide things. And so in the children's book, there is that. Now, obviously the new book, because an adult book, it's far more, far deeper and far worse, because I can see things through an adult eye rather than a child's eye. So, but you can't hide things that happened. But I think like the new book now, I wouldn't like children to read it. Put this, I wouldn't like, you know, very young children to read it. But I think teenagers would be no problem. But I think you have to be sensitive and in a way that they can take it in and understand it and also get emotionally involved, that it's not distant from them, that they can think about it and talk about it. And I know every class in Ireland who is under the Hawthorne Tree, there will be discussion about the baby dying. Mm. There will be a discussion. Mm. The teachers all tell me, the teachers say, oh, I'm very tearful. And the children will talk about it and all the different things they see along the way. You know, they're attacked by dogs and things like that. And there's always a discussion about this. And teachers are brilliant how they approach this kind of writing and history. You know, and history is so important. Our history is so important. I'm mad on history and I just love writing history and want people to, you know, care about history and our history, especially here in Ireland, because we have such a big history and sometimes we forget about it.
Well, I think that's the danger with the famine story intrigues is the wrong word, but I find it so fascinating in that it seems to have been not forgotten, in fairness, but I don't think we will ever understand or fathom the enormity of it.
It's I think when you talk about a million people dying, and you talk a million people emigrating, it's so big it's very hard to actually take that on board. And the statistics are all there and the lists are all there and the government things are all there. But really when you're a writer, my job as a writer is to take history and put flesh on the bones of it, to make you care about. I can't make you care about a million, but I can make you care about four or five or six or eight people. Yeah. And I can make you care about them. And that's my job as a writer, to do that.
That's right. I mean, you're talking about children in history for a second, and I think about John Boy and the Boy in Striped Pyjamas trying to talk about the Holocaust, if you like, in Auschwitz. And then this story, which is the famine story, and you've done this adult book, as you call it, The Hungry Road, is... You know, I've said before, and I believe that the famine was our Holocaust.
It was, yeah.
And I remember talking to the author Philip Sands, who had written about essentially the Nazis and what have you, the Jewish people and so on. And I said to him over a drink once, "Are we allowed to say Holocaust in Ireland about what happened to us?" And he said, "Of course you are." And this is a Jewish man saying, "Of course you are, because you had this unspeakable horror fall upon you as a people." So it's not to be disrespectful to anyone else to call it that, but it was. When you have a million, like that exodus then of people fleeing the country. But I still don't think we have this. We have processed the enormity of it. Still,
I think. Well, I always call it the Great Hunger, the Great Famine, you know, because that's what it was. And but I think the enormity of it. But you have to then go into it. Like when I did Under the Hawthorn Tree, I was telling the story through three small children, the eyes of them, which it was a more local story. But now the new book, I'm telling it through adult eyes. I'm telling it through the local doctor, the local priest, a tenant, farmers, the families, people of the town. And so you're getting the big picture through adult eyes of the story. And that's the only way you can really take in the story. Mm-hmm. You can have all the statistics in the world, but you have to really care. And if you don't care, you're lost.
You're right. And you bring it local. And local helps us understand, you know, micro helps us understand macro.
Yeah.
And with your book, I'm looking at, you know, you bring us into these little... they're not houses, they're sheds and shacks and so on. And especially with the first, you know, 50 pages or whatever, the strong men, strong women, sturdy children, and then the descent into pain and hunger and shame and all of these things that they didn't deserve, but the reduction and the obliteration of humanity.
And the book is really, I think, about courage, kindness of good people and the strength of the human spirit. And really writing the book and researching the book, the strength of the human spirit is really what I wanted to capture, because, you know, Mary Sullivan, one of the main characters in the book, she's they're tenants, small tenants, poor tenants. Mm. And she will fight tooth and nail for her children to survive. And I wanted to show that mothers could do that. Mm. And yet the doctor's wife, Henrietta, who they're wealthy, he's the town doctor, she equally will fight to protect her children from what's going on in the town. Well, you know, it's just, and then you have the doctor who, God help him, is thrown into this nightmare scenario of suddenly thousands invading the town, sick and diseased, and trying to get into the workhouse. And, you know, but you know, how people, you know, people think we're all victims, but I wanted to show people fought back.
Yeah.
And I wanted in the book to show they fought back. They, the town people got together and they set up a soup kitchen. And they, long before the government ever did it, in Skibbereen, the people opened a soup kitchen in November 1846, which fed thousands of people every day.
Yeah.
They did it themselves. People came to this old mill from all over West Cork and walked to get the soup. And they, the poor men who were working on the roads were starving, and they marched into town trying to riot, but God help them, they hadn't the strength to riot.
Yeah.
But they came in with their shovels and picks, demanding to be paid, demanding food, and, you know, were then put off by just giving biscuits or something to eat. But they, the fight was there, but in the end, the fight, you know, it was too big a fight for them, you know. But the fight kept there, and the townspeople, the doctor, the priest, the local solicitor, they fought tooth and nail. I mean, the Protestant minister, Reverend Townsend, went over to England and met Charles Trevelyan to ask him for help for their town.
He was some creature, wasn't he?
Yeah. Asked for help.
He thought it was God's will as punishment to lazy people.
Yeah.
And this, I mean, when you think of the language of that, it makes my blood boil.
And Daniel O'Connell himself, who has been ignored in Irish history the last few years, that started the book. I wanted to start it on a high point, not on a low point.
Yeah.
And Daniel O'Connell comes to Skibbereen, and 80,000 people came to see him.
Yeah.
Skibbereen was booming. It was a booming town, a very wealthy provincial town, and so many people walked that day to see Daniel O'Connell. And Ireland was full of hope. O'Connell was going to get a parliament back in Ireland, going to fight for tenants to get their own rights of their land back. They wouldn't always be just paying to landlords. And then suddenly, you know, Daniel O'Connell's arrested, things change, and 2 years later, whammy.
When they smell in the wind, the potatoes.
Yeah,
and
it's
amazing. You can almost feel it. Life moves in slow motion.
Yeah,
and then they're into the drills and they're plucking out this muck and putrefied filth and going, we are in some trouble here.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really, it's breathtakingly upsetting.
Yeah, I found with the research, and Dr. Dan Donovan, he was an amazing, the doctor, because he had written this diary of a dispensary doctor, and which you can read, and I was able to read, and he reported every day, even though this man was every day in the dispensary with the sick, in the workhouse where there were, workhouse was so overcrowded, the conditions were terrible there in the end. He was round the lanes, he was dealing with the dead, he was organising pits.
So he was a real person?
He's a real person.
And did you use any of his,
diary in your book? Oh yeah,
what
he wrote I've used, because...
Is that his writing?
Yeah, that's what he said.
Right.
What he did, most of the stuff he's done is in the book. And I just thought he was this incredible man, a hero, a true hero.
Yeah.
And what he did, and yet, even though he did it all day, he went out in the middle of the night helping people bury children in, little things in the near cottages in the middle of nowhere. He got up from his house and went out, and yet came home at night and wrote this diary. And what happened was, his diary then, he was a highly intelligent, meticulous man, but really compassionate and caring. And his diary was published in, first of all, in the Cork papers, then in the Irish papers, then was picked up by the Illustrated London News, which is next to the Times in England, was the biggest newspaper at the time, and also picked up by some of the foreign press and the American papers. And this brought attention to what was going on in Ireland.
Yeah.
This one doctor, the priest was writing, Reverend Townsend was writing, and then the very famous artist, James Mahoney.
And he features, so he comes into
comes
the...
In,
yeah,
and he's,
yeah,
real,
and he's real as well. Oh, my God.
And he came,
really,
and Dr. Dan showed him around.
Yeah, and he could barely take it because it was just so...
off. And he was sketching. He was a landscape artist.
Yeah.
Normally, he wasn't, you know, but his paper, you know, had read Dr. Dan's reports, were publishing them, and they said, would he go to Cork and would he meet Dr. Dan and bring him around? So he went, and they are the iconic pictures we see of the famine now that are everywhere. So Dr. Dan showed him around. And just to have these eyes, like the doctor's eyes, the artist's eyes, the priest's eyes, and Mary Sullivan, who probably is the strongest female character I've ever written.
Yeah.
She's a seamstress. She ends up sewing shrouds for the dead in Skibbereen.
And breaking stones. You know, for
yeah.
four pennies. You know, yeah, I mean, it is remarkable. And, you know, we were down in Skibbereen a few years ago.
Oh,
and
have you been there?
And Terry, you probably know from...
Yeah, the Heritage Centre.
And, you know, then more recently we were in Skull. And driving through all the places that you mentioned in the book, Union Hall, Ballydehob, Skull... And all beautiful little villages and
it's all
and
picturesque.
Towns. You're right. And if you, I was reading your book and I was just thinking, I wish I could go back just for a minute to see, so that we could come back then and try and remember it again. But at least we have those diaries that you mentioned.
Yeah.
And that sense of history.
And we have James Mahoney's illustrations.
And the illustrations.
And there's letters from loads of people and different things. Soup kitchen, where the soup kitchen was in the mill in Skibbereen, that's still there. Now it needs to be restored and the talk plans may be restored.
I hope they do.
Because Skibbereen is almost like a monument to the famine.
Right.
That graveyard, Abbey Story, you know, the way out of Skull?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, my mother's buried there.
Is she really?
My mother's family are from Skibbereen.
Yeah.
So she's actually buried, but that is the famine grave.
The mass grave.
Yeah, 9,000 coffinless bodies are buried there. And it's most beautiful, overlooking the river on the way to Skull. It's just absolutely picturesque and beautiful. And you'd never believe that what happened there. But it was a story there for the telling. And I was wondering, why has no one told? I've already done the famine. I don't need to go do it again. Am I gone mad, bonkers? But then once I started reading his diaries, once I stood in Abbestrury, once I walked the town, and like you said, driving and seeing these abandoned wards, old cottages, that is a story. And as a writer, there's stories for the telling. And if you're lucky, you can grab the story and start to shape it and make it. And it took 3 years to put flesh on those bones because I wanted to do it properly. And my publishers were very good. It should have been out last year or probably even earlier. I didn't, in the end, the contexts were all being ignored. We just went,
no, you did the right thing. Breathe.
Write it.
Do it in your own time. And rather than rush something out, I think that was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
It passes my test of, you know, you've got an hour to read. Great. And I can't wait, as opposed to you better read that. And I'm nearly finished it, but it's eminently readable, but
it's big,
it brings you there.
But it's epic. And of course, I don't know if you got yet, but you know, they go to America later on in the book. I
haven't got there yet.
With the famine ship going over. I won't tell you because you've a lot of stuff ahead of you.
No, because I read, obviously, the Star of the Sea would be similar to the, in terms of the ship going across, and that gets that sense. And every time I go to New York, there's a famine memorial there. Do you know it? Between two big buildings. And it is a knockout. If anyone's going to New York, you must go to see it, because New York, Gros Seal in Canada, right back to back over to Australia, and of course across the Irish Sea to the UK. I always say all those Irish bars with bikes on the walls, like, they're not born out of a joyful, strangely desire to be there. We were forced out because we were starving, and we were one after another shoved onto these boats. Like you described that boat that was meant for corn, and that's going across. Empty, so the doctor shoves a bunch of people on it politely.
Yeah, the boats went to New York now, the conditions were terrible.
That's a different story.
But in the year 1847, Mary Sullivan and her family end up, they're evicted and they go on the ship to New York. But 52,000 people that year landed from Ireland in New York. The top population in New York was 340,000. 52,000 people in 1 year went from Ireland. It's a mind-boggling. And 90% of them stayed in New York.
Yeah.
They stayed in New York. So that's how the Irish thing happened in America.
Yeah.
Because that's where they came. And it was really strange. One thing I did find researching the ships, that in one way they thought they had escaped. They were going across the ocean, crossing the Atlantic. And yet, the more I read accounts and different things that happened, I felt like the famine was like a ghost and it stepped onto the ship with them.
Yes.
And it followed them across.
Yeah.
Like someone they got over. The Sullivans were fighters. They were courageous. They were going to survive. But unfortunately, someone they got over, they were so traumatised and that ghost clung to them and they didn't do well in New York. They couldn't lift themselves up. They were the ones that say, oh, they're terrible. The poor Irish, the drunk Irish, whatever in New York. But the majority of them did raise themselves up.
Yeah, they did. And look, we
and
know
in
what
the book,
happened.
And in the book, there is a happy ending, I do promise, you know.
Yeah.
Because I'm not going to
leave
them.
Don't give it away now.
No, but it was an epic story to write. And I thought, am I bonkers, absolutely bonkers to write this story.
But no, I'm delighted you did, because it got, as I say, it'll get people who are interested in this period of history just back into the zone, if you like. And now already I want to go back to Strokestown to visit the museum there.
Oh, Strokestown is incredible.
Incredible, yeah.
And actually, in Strokestown, 1,400 people were evicted from Strokestown. I was involved in the National Famine Way. It's along the canal.
Yes.
And 1,490 people were evicted from Strokestown and had to walk to Dublin along the canal. On Royal Canal.
Amazing.
They had no shoes, some of them, so they had to actually give them shoes so they could walk. And they got the ships where the custom house is. They got ships from there to Liverpool and then on to America. To Gros Isle.
Yes.
And a huge amount of them died on that journey.
Of course.
I think there were four lots of ships because there were 1,490 and the bailiff walked them. It took them. They went through all those towns. And I was... Strokestown, a National Famine Way, asked me to write a thing for that, which I've done.
Mm-hmm.
And if you walk that way, there's an app, you can go on the site as well. And there was a boy called Daniel Ty and his sister Catherine, and they did that National Famine. They walked that canal and they were one of the few survivors that they survived Gros Isle. Unfortunately, their mother and that died in Gros Isle, and they survived in Canada. And Daniel actually did well later on in Canada, his generation, his family. And they've come back to Strokestown. So I've been quite involved in Strokestown as well. I don't know, I've just been dragged into the famine, no matter what I do. Yeah,
yeah. Well, that's understandable. I was trying to think of was anyone ever recorded on radio, on microphone, talking about the famine experience? In other words, I was going through 1847 and trying to add the decades to see, did anyone make it alive to say, I remember it? Or because it's not that long ago.
Yeah.
And when I was reading your book over the weekend, I found myself drawn to, I went on YouTube to find a documentary about the Irish famine. And they began it, this particular documentary began by going to, do you remember, Live Aid, Ethiopia?
Yeah.
And that footage. And he was describing the Irish story, but using footage from Ethiopia.
Yeah.
So the bodies, the shrouds,
yeah.
the side of the road, the abandonment. And it was very eerie because you thought, now, because we don't have any footage of this.
Yeah.
So that's why the Quinnipiac
University, yeah.
That amazing art exhibition.
Yeah, I was involved in that too. It was brilliant.
Right,
yeah.
So that was essentially,
yeah.
as I remember the lady saying it at the time, that's YouTube. Those paintings are...
Because it wasn't photographs,
exactly.
And they actually have James Mahoney's illustrations. Have some of them.
That makes perfect sense.
You see, unfortunately, and I've actually... I it's one of my bees in my bonnet that I wish Ireland had its own collection.
Yeah.
That is a thing I would love to see, Ireland having its own art collection, because some of the artists there in Quinnipiac in the Great Hunger Museum there, they're still alive here in Ireland. John Bee and people like that who've done famine sculpture, Rowan Gillespie. We should have a national collection. That is
my
belief.
Let's get talking. There should be no reason why we can't, you know, move that along at some point.
But
because you need more work. Marita, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. We have so much more we could have talked about. We might talk again, because what you've done is a great service, I think, to history.
Ryan, you're so good. Thank you
really,
so much.
No, really, I thoroughly enjoyed this book. I raced through it. I have a bit more left and I can't wait to go back to finish it.
Yeah.
It's called The Hungry Road by Marita Colin McKenna. The amount of text from people who are reminiscing about under the hawthorn tree, Rebel Sisters, of course, about the Gifford sisters that you put in through. Please tell Marita, my 8th grade class in France, read and study The Wildflower Girl, a great favourite of ours, from Amanda Harrison, College Jacqueline de Romilly, Manu de Langres in France. Word of thanks to Marita, read The Hawthorn Tree under the hawthorn 30 years ago as an 8-year-old, had a profound effect on me as a child and majorly promoted my interest in history and reading, which remains to this day. So you've created this great legacy. And on it goes. Jennifer says, lovely to hear Marita. Our teacher read Under the Hawthorn Tree to us in 6th class in 1898. I loved it. I wrote a letter to her in Braille and was so happy to get a lovely letter back answering all my questions. So you keep doing what you do. And thanks for coming to see us today. And good luck with the book.
Thanks so.
Not at all. Thanks Marita Colin McKenna joining us on the show this morning. The Hungry Road is the book we've been talking about. And it's a must add to your collection if you're in the bookshops today. Back with more after this.